here first. There we go. Good morning again. It's so nice to be with you this morning. I really appreciate you asking me to come and speak this morning. I'm not normally a preacher by trade, but I do just like to fill in from time to time, and this I'm always seeking opportunities just to kind of expand my repertoire or to just get some more experience in the pulpit. So I thank you. I am a teacher, so if this seems less preachy and more teachy, I guess, then that's the reason for that. I was really excited. I was kind of as some guidance for what we should be talking about. I was told about your theme for the year, which is from Nehemiah 4:6, talking about having a mind to work. And I really like that theme, especially for this year. You know, after the year we've had this past year, and just it seemed like we couldn't do much during that time. So just to kind of refocus and get our mind going toward working, I think that concept is a really, really good focus for the year. So as I was talking about that and considering what we would talk about this morning, I kind of looked at it from the negative side. What might deter us? What are some things that might prevent us from working, from having that mind to work? What are some ideas, or what are some just deterrents? What might keep us from doing that? And so I started to kind of look through the Bible, and just there's kind of a theme that I want us to look at throughout the Bible, and we'll see that in a minute. But there's something that seemed to always distract the people from, we'll see, starting in Genesis all the way through kind of the history parts of the Bible. I mean, almost throughout the entire Bible, there's this constant thing that's kind of holding them back and keeping them from having that mind to work. And I think that distraction, or that thing that they would always look back toward, was Egypt. And of course we know Egypt, the country, you know, is a pretty big part of the Bible narrative, a pretty big part of the history of God's people. I mean, they were there for 400 years, they were slaves. You know, God brought them out by a mighty hand through the Exodus and the plagues and all of that. But it just seemed like they were always looking back toward Egypt. Constantly, there was something about Egypt. There was like an allure or temptation, even before the 400 years of slavery in Egypt. The patriarchs still had an issue with Egypt and its temptation, and it's just the things that it offered. The God's people were constantly longing for this sense of safety and comfort that Egypt provided. So what I thought I'd do this morning is just look through several, kind of go through the Bible very quickly. I'll have most of the verses on the screen, but I definitely hope that you'll join me, open your Bibles as we look at some of the many times that Egypt provided a distraction or even tempted God's people. And we'll look at what resulted when that happened. And then hopefully at the end, I want us to kind of apply that to ourselves and just talk about what is our Egypt. What are some things that might distract us or prevent us from having this mind to work that you guys are that you are focused on this year? So I hope you'll join me. Open your Bibles. We're going to start in Genesis chapter 12. So if you'll turn there with me, Genesis chapter 12. Like I said, we think of Egypt definitely with Exodus, but we don't really realize that Egypt kind of starts to pick up here even in Genesis chapter 12. So if you'll turn there with me, and we'll look at that together. We see right off the bat, this is actually Abraham. And if you remember the beginning of Genesis chapter 12, we're introduced to Abraham. He's called by God. He's given all these wonderful promises. And he travels from Haran in the east all the way to Canaan, this great act of faith. And we see he arrives in Canaan. He builds an altar there in verse 8. And he journeys to the Negev in verse 9. And then in verse 10, he's just gotten to Canaan. And in verse 10, what happens? There is a famine in the land. So Abraham, what does he do? He goes down to Egypt to stay there for a while because the famine was severe. And we'll see that this isn't the first time, or this isn't the last time that this kind of thing will happen. There's going to be famine in the land, and God's people are going to Egypt. Well, why? Well, what do we know about Egypt? What do we know about the Nile River? The Nile River was their source of water. There was their source of prosperity there, and it was pretty much immune to famine. So whenever there's famine throughout the other lands that relied on rainfall, well, Egypt was fine because they had this consistent Nile River that overflowed its banks, and that's where their prosperity came from. That's where their water came from, and there wasn't any famine that would really stop that from happening until, I guess, the days of Joseph. So Egypt was this place of safety, this place a place they didn't have to worry about these types of things. So again, right off the bat, here's Abraham. He goes down to Egypt, and that doesn't seem so bad until you continue to read the story. What happens while he's down there? Well, the Pharaoh at the time, he sees Abraham's wife, Sarah, and she's beautiful. And what does he do? He takes her into his harem, if you will. He takes her as his wife, and I mean, this is a great threat to all the promises that God has made. So what does God do? He actually sends some plagues in verse 17. He sends a severe plague against Pharaoh. Spoiler alert, that's not the last time that's going to happen as well. So he sends a plague on Pharaoh, and Pharaoh figures, you know, he figures out what's going on. So he gives Sarai, I guess, at the time. He gives Sarai back to Abram, and kind of a little bit of crisis averted there, but there was, this was almost a disastrous trip by going down to Egypt when, you know, was that really the best option? He'd just gotten to Canaan, and it seems like there was a lack of faith that brought him down to Egypt. There's a famine, yeah, but did he not think that God would take care of him while he was in Canaan? We're not really told that in the Bible, but it does seem like this is a failure on Abram's part that is going to continue as we read these stories. This is just the beginning of this kind of mindset, looking to Egypt for this for safety. Isaac, the same thing happens to him in Genesis chapter 26. So turn there. Genesis, Abraham, his son. He finally has a son named Isaac. You would think he would learn from some of his father's mistakes, but the same thing kind of happens here. Look at verse 2. Genesis chapter 26 and verse 2. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land that I tell you about. Stay in this land as an alien, and I will be with you and bless you. For I will give all these lands to you and your offspring, and will confirm the oath that I swore to your father Abraham." So there seems to be a desire on Isaac's part as well, which again, there was another famine. We didn't read that in verse 1. There was another famine in the land, and he was wanting to do the same thing, go down to Egypt. But the Lord prevented him from doing that this time. But even Isaac, he has not learned that lesson of avoiding, leaving, staying away from Egypt. Fast forward to the next generation. We've got Abraham, we've got Isaac. Now we have Jacob. This is probably a little more well-known. Look at Genesis chapter 46. Fast forward ahead, Genesis chapter 46. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." So he said, "I am the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes." So this is, in the context here, this is during that difficult time that Joseph had known about through his dreams, through the dreams of Pharaoh, those 7 years of plenty. Well, now we're in the 7 years of famine, and that famine spread throughout the entire world. And Joseph's brothers came down to Egypt just to buy grain. And they finally reunite with Joseph, and Joseph is going to bring down his family. Jacob, to his credit, seems to have learned the lesson that his father and grandfather didn't, and he is asking, he's inquiring of God if he should even go down to Egypt. And the Lord actually tells him to go, so he does have permission here. Probably one of two times I can think of that the Lord actually gives permission to go down to Egypt. And of course, we kind of know the bigger picture. We know that the point of that was for Israel to grow into this great mighty nation. But what happens while they're down in Egypt? 400 years of slavery. I mean, this was definitely not going to be a very good trip for the Israelites as a whole. But good would come out of it, in that they would be able to grow and prosper. And eventually the Lord will bring them out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Fast forward a little bit to after that Exodus. You would think that after 400 years of life in Egypt under the oppressive thumb of Pharaoh, that the Israelites would have no desire to go back to Egypt. Well, look what happens as soon, literally like the chapter after they leave Egypt, and God has delivered them through the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army's been destroyed. They're finally free. They've left Egypt. And what happens just a chapter later? Look at Exodus chapter 16. Exodus 14, they escape through the Red Sea. Exodus 15, they sing about escaping through the Red Sea. And then Exodus 16 and verse 3, it says, "The Israelites said to them, 'If only we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat and ate all the bread we wanted. Instead, you brought us into the wilderness to make this whole assembly die of hunger.'" At this point, they've literally been gone maybe a couple days at the most. This is not a very long time frame from the Red Sea to this point. And, you know, they're in the desert. There's not any food or water. They're only carrying basically what they could carry on themselves. They don't have a ton of caravans, you know, carrying water and food. So their food and their water is running out. And what are they doing already? They're complaining. They are wishing they were back in Egypt. It still boggles my mind. I mean, they've forgotten so quickly that they were slaves. They had food, but that was not a good life back there. They were crying out because of the oppression of Pharaoh, and it had actually gotten worse during the plagues because Pharaoh was even more harsh against them. And apart from that, you would think that they would have learned by all the signs and wonders that God could take care of them. He's not going to bring them out just to die, but that's what they said. If only we had died by the Lord's hand with the Egyptians, you know, we should have just drowned in the Red Sea, or we should have been killed by whatever plagues that God sent against the Egyptians. It would have been better than to come out here and starve. They were already looking back to Egypt, and their minds had changed. They had already started to elevate Egypt more than it was. They had forgotten how those days of slavery. They had forgotten those times, how bad those times were, and how much better it was to serve the Lord and to be with Him. Fast forward to Numbers chapter 14. Numbers chapter 14. This will be probably about a year later. This is going to be after the giving of the law on Mount Sinai, and they've left Mount Sinai. They are heading to go and conquer the land. Just maybe a year later. And Numbers 14 and verse 2, "All the Israelites complained about Moses and Aaron, and the whole community told them, 'If only we had died in the land of Egypt, and if only we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into the land to die by the sword? Our wives and children will become plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let's appoint a leader and go back to Egypt.'" So not a year later, they've sent these 12 spies into the land to spy out Canaan and bring back a report. Well, we know that the 10 spies brought back a negative report and said, "We are not mighty enough. We cannot take this land. They are too great." And only two spies, Joshua and Caleb, were the ones that said, let's go. We've got this. We can do it. We can take it. God is with us. And of course, the people believed the ten, and they were ready to basically take out Moses and Aaron. They were going to appoint a new leader, and they were going to, I assume, they would have marched right back to Egypt and just said, you know, sorry, Pharaoh. I don't even know how that would have happened, but they wanted to go back to Egypt. They were scared. They wanted to go back to that place. Even though they were slaves, at least they could live. They were scared that they would die. They'd forgotten all of these. They'd forgotten that the Lord, the God that they served, had destroyed Pharaoh in Egypt, as was more powerful than all of those armies. And if he could destroy Egypt, he could destroy all the cities in Canaan, no matter how big or tall the people there were. But they had forgotten that, and they were ready to turn around and go back to Egypt. We kind of remember these stories with the Israelites during this wilderness wandering period, but even years later, after the judges, after Samuel and Saul and David, there's still kind of a mindset amongst the Israelites during the kingdom period of they remember Egypt. They were constantly trying to be like Egypt. Solomon, for one, was always doing things that reminded that kind of pointed toward Egypt. In 1 Kings chapter 3, so fast forward a couple pages, a couple books to 1 Kings chapter 3. What does Solomon do? He makes a treaty. He makes a treaty with Pharaoh of Egypt and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. So if you remember, what's kind of one of the rules that they have in the law of Moses? Were they supposed to marry foreign women like that? No, they were supposed to marry within the nation of Israel. And why was that? Well, these foreign women, like Pharaoh's daughter, they would draw their hearts away from God. And that's exactly what happens. This is just the biggest incident of Solomon marrying outside of the family of God. But we know that Solomon married 1,000 women, and most of his heart was drawn away from God. And why would he marry someone, you know, the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt? He wanted to make peace with them. That's usually what you did if you married a princess of some kind. The idea was to have an alliance or make peace. Well, I mean, the Egyptians were their masters, their slave drivers. Why would you want to make peace with this wicked people? But that's what Solomon did, and his later on in his life, he's going to pay the price for that. Look at just some other verses. 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 30. Of course, Solomon is known for his wisdom. His great wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Kind of interesting there. Like, why is Egypt mentioned? Well, they were mentioned here because they were so wise. Well, weren't there? I mean, there were wise men in the East. Like, why Egypt specifically? I think there's still a mindset that, you know, Egypt and their long history and their, you know, their great pyramids and whatever they offered, that was almost like a gold standard of wisdom for that time period. And really, it was Solomon. Solomon was this gold standard of wisdom during this time. We know the Queen of Sheba came up to hear about him and just learn about his wisdom and see how he ruled. And what does she do? She praises God because of that. She doesn't praise Solomon. She realizes that it was the God of Solomon that brought this great wealth and this great prosperity and this great wisdom to him. And that was the point. That was what it was supposed to be. People looking to Israel for their wisdom and their knowledge, because they had the most intimate knowledge of the one true God. And that was what it was supposed to be, not Israel looking back, Israel looking toward Egypt for their worldly wisdom and knowledge. But we kind of see that mindset here. Look at 1 Kings chapter 10 and verse 28, 1 Kings 10, 28. As also Solomon had horses imported from Egypt in Keva. The king's merchants brought them in Keva at the current price. Now a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, and a horse 150, And thus, through their agents, they exported them all to the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. What was something that the Lord had warned them back in the book of the law? He had specifically warned the kings not to amass these great chariots. And what is Solomon doing? He's amassing a great, mighty army full of chariots. And where? From Egypt. He's trying to model his kingdom after the kingdom and the might of Egypt. Well, what did that might get Egypt? They were destroyed by God in the Red Sea. Wouldn't it be better to do what the Lord God, who is mightier than all the horses and chariots of Egypt, wouldn't it be better to do his will than to try to mimic or try to copy his nation just like that of Egypt? God had told them in Deuteronomy chapter 17, "You shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren, you shall set as king over you." And what does he say? "You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother." But, verse 16, "He shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again." That is powerful right there. Do not return that way again to multiply horses. And I see this as not just about horses. This is, I think, has a bigger spiritual meaning than just how many horses you have. And what has Solomon done? He's multiplied his horses. He's returned to Egypt to get those horses and get those chariots. And of course, what does that do? That builds a reliance on Egypt. That's where you've got your might and your power and your horses and your chariots. It's not from God, it's from Egypt. Well, obviously that is a most dangerous mindset, and I think that's even just another reason why Solomon ends up falling away. And this man of great wisdom still couldn't, you know, did not know the law well enough to avoid what ends up happening to him. He amassed too many wives, he amassed too many horses, and he lost his faith down the road. Fast forward again to the divided kingdom period. So Solomon, we know what happens to his son. The kingdom is torn away from him. And now we have two kingdoms, the northern kingdom in Israel and the southern kingdom in Judah. Well, it seems like from time to time, those kingdoms were not as strong as Solomon's united kingdom. They never were. And they were always fighting against their neighbors and being taken over, being attacked by the Arameans or the Assyrians or the Babylonians or whoever it was. And there was always one nation, and even the Egyptians at times as well. And there was always one nation that they were constantly kind of hoping to be saved by, and that was Egypt. This is 2 Kings chapter 18. This is actually in the days of Hezekiah when the Assyrians, they came down and actually captured the northern kingdom. This is the end of the northern kingdom around 722 BC. They capture the northern kingdom, and the Assyrians are going to continue their campaign into Judah, looking to take them over. They've surrounded Jerusalem. They've besieged Jerusalem. And the representative for the king of the Assyrians, he says, "Now look, you are trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. How then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants," this is verse 24, "and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen?" It's kind of funny. This is the Rabshakeh, basically like the captain of the guard of the Assyrian. This isn't the king, but the general of the army. And you know, this is a wicked, wicked man. You know, he's not a follower of God in any way. But you know, could more truth be spoken by someone than that in verse 21? You know, "You trust in the staff of this broken reed on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it." That was Egypt. And he is 100% right. They were leaning on this broken staff of a country in Egypt that, you know, that is going to pierce them if they lean too hard. And that's, I mean, that's what's happened time and time again. They place their trust in Egypt, and what has it done? It's enslaved them, or it's turned around and attacked them. We, going back to Solomon, you know, what happens to Solomon's son, Rehoboam? He actually loses half the kingdom, and then at some point later on in his reign, Egypt attacks him. Well, I thought Solomon had, you know, married the daughter of Pharaoh, and shouldn't there be an alliance between the two? Well, that sure didn't last very long, did it? Didn't last but one generation. So, you know, the Israelites were constantly just looking toward Egypt, and it was a broken staff. It was, they were building a foundation, to use New Testament language. They were building on a foundation of sand when they should have been building on a rock, which was a trusting in the Lord. And even the Lord uses these wicked Assyrians as a warning to them to not trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen. Isaiah talks about this in chapter 31. Of course, Isaiah was a contemporary to Hezekiah, and his books kind of talk about these events during those days. Woe to those, in verse 1, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but who do not look at the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. Verse 3, now the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses are flesh and not spirit. When the Lord stretches out his hand, both he who helps will fall, and he who is helped will fall down. They all will perish together. So Isaiah just warning them, woe to those who trust in Egypt. They are just flesh and bone. Their horses are flesh and bone. And when the Lord stretches out his hand, that is not flesh and bone, it is spirit and power. All those that trusted in Egypt, and the Egyptians themselves, those that helped and those that were helped, they will all fall before the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. So Egypt was a constant, they were constantly looking to help for Egypt, and really the main theme that we see throughout the Bible is that Egypt represented slavery and sin. Look at Exodus chapter 13. Moses said, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. Later in Leviticus, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their slaves. I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you walk upright. Moses here, and later on the Lord in Leviticus, he's trying to help them remember that they were slaves. They were in the house of bondage, and it is the Lord, by the strength of his hand, that brought them out. Egypt is slavery. Why would you look to them for help, for strength? Why would you ever want to go back to a time of slavery? Deuteronomy chapter 6, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. The Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh and all his household. Then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in to give us the land of which he swore to our fathers. They were to teach this concept, to teach this idea that, you know, Egypt was a place of bondage, a place of slavery, to their children. They were supposed to pass this down from generation to generation when they ask. Remind them that they were slaves, and it was the Lord that brought them out. And clearly that did not get passed down to the generations that we spoke of, the days of Solomon, the days of Isaiah and Hezekiah, all of those. None of them remembered. They were constantly looking back to that time. So that leads us all the way to the New Testament. And we kind of see right at the beginning of Matthew here, if you've read through the Old Testament, which, you know, the early readers of the Bible, of Matthew, would have known that Old Testament very well. So I would assume they would kind of pick up on the danger here that we read about in chapter 2 of Matthew. Chapter 2, verse 13, now when they had departed, Behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod. Stopping right there, I think that should be a red flag. We're worried, okay, we've read about this child, this, you know, hopefully this Messiah that is coming, that was foretold throughout all the Old Testament. And, oh no, there's a threat to him by Herod, and he's fleeing to Egypt. Oh no, is this going to be a repeat of what happened with the Israelites over and over again? Abraham going down and almost losing Sarah, and then, you know, that Jacob and the 12 sons going down and being enslaved, and the people constantly looking back to Egypt. But this was to fulfill what the Lord said concerning through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I call my son. This was a fulfillment of prophecy because Jesus is showing the way, showing how it should have been. So he is doing the same thing that the Israelites did, except he's going to do it differently and better. So he comes back from Egypt, lives his life, grows up, and he's even tempted in the same ways that we are. Flip over to Matthew. We'll look at that one. Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4. Of course, this is when Jesus, as a grown man, goes out into the wilderness and spends 40 days out there, and during which he's tempted by the devil. And Matthew chapter 4, you know, he's getting three temptations, right? He's given the temptation of bread. Well, kind of the same thing that the Israelites were tempted by. They didn't have enough bread. So what happens? They lost their faith and they were wanting to go back to Egypt. Did the same thing happen with Jesus? No. What does he say there in verse 4, chapter 4 and verse 4? He says, he quotes the scripture that they should have known way back then. It says, man must not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. So we already see just a huge difference with Jesus compared to the story of the Israelites. He's not returning to Egypt. He's not succumbing to these temptations. Look at the second temptation. What did the devil tempt him with? He took him to the holy city, had him stand on the pinnacle, and just said, you know, if you are the Son of God, verse 6, he will give his angels orders concerning you. They will support you with their hands so that you will not strike your foot against the stone. This is the temptation of comfort. He's tempting Jesus to use his power to avoid discomfort, to avoid striking his foot on a stone. And again, Jesus meets the test and exceeds it. And what does he do? He uses scripture. He says in verse 7, do not test the Lord your God. And then, of course, the third one, the devil takes him up on the high mountain, shows him all the kingdoms of the world. In verse 9, I will give you all these things if you will fall down and worship me. He offers him power. Well, as much power as the devil has, which is obviously limited. But he offers him that power, and that's kind of the same temptation that the Israelites had when they were constantly looking back for horses and chariots. They were trying to amass power from Egypt. But where is the source of true power? It is only from God, God alone. So Jesus says in verse 10, go away, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. So Christ leads the way out of Egypt. He left Egypt and he did not look back. He did not succumb to the temptations like the Israelites did. His life is an example for us to follow. And the Israelites were the example to not follow. They were looking back toward Egypt and toward that life of sin. And Jesus is the way out of that. Look at Hebrews chapter 2. It talks about this as well. Hebrews 2. Therefore, in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. So it was necessary for Jesus to do this, to live, you know, follow that same pattern of life that the Israelites did, but to show them the way out, to to be tempted and not to succumb to that temptation, so that he can be that merciful and faithful high priest for us. And he can aid those of us that are still being tempted. We are, in this analogy, we are like Israel. We have not been like Jesus. We have been more like Israel. We are constantly failing. We are constantly looking back toward that life of slavery and sin. But we look to Jesus as our example, someone to follow, because he was made just like us. And he's shown us the way, and that way is possible if we choose it. So like I said, I want us to kind of think about, apply that to us today. What is your Egypt? You know, we obviously have a little bit of different, you know, we were not enslaved in a foreign country and actually served as slaves, but we have served sin. We have served Satan in times past. So what is our Egypt? You know, hopefully, you know, those of us that have been baptized and given ourselves over to the gospel, we know that we should not look back toward our former life. But what are those things? What do you look back to? What are some things that might keep you from moving forward or having a mind to work like you were focused on this week? Could it be maybe just an old routine or habit that you're having trouble shaking, or a place of comfort, a person of comfort that you an activity, something that you used to do in your past that's constantly drawing you back? I know one thing I've seen over the course of this year with COVID and everything, get back to normal. Well, I know what they mean by that. Hopefully they mean being able to worship more often and spend time with their brothers, but for some, I wonder if that means getting back to when things were easier. I'll admit this is a difficult time right now. There's a lot of changes. There's a lot of things that have happened over this past year that have really, thrown a kink in the wheels, if you will. But I honestly think that a lot of these things, there might be good for us. Is it better to sit back and be comfortable and happy, or to have a little more difficulty, have some challenges to face? Because I think before things were easy, things were normal, things were routine. We were happy with our cushy lives, if you will. And things have been less easy and less comfortable and less normal. What is the pattern we see throughout the Bible? Egypt was kind of easy. There was a pattern. They had food to eat. They didn't have to worry about that. Yes, they were slaves, but they had homes. Things were consistent, I guess you should say. Well, things got very difficult for the Israelites when they had to wander through a wilderness and they didn't have as much food to eat. They had to rely, they had to trust on the goodness and mercy of God, which is, it's very difficult. They didn't always know, I guess. They didn't trust that they were going to get manna every day or have enough to eat or to drink. They were constantly running into foreign peoples that were trying to kill them. And they were a nation, but they were not the mightiest nation on earth by any chance. They could not rely on their, their numbers and their military power to keep them safe. They had to rely on God, and that is difficult. And I think through that difficulty, that's where faith comes. I think that's where trust in the Lord comes. So it's weird to say, but I'm thankful for this past year. I think it's brought us from a easy, cushy life to maybe something a little more difficult, something a little more challenging. And in terms of just ourselves, our evangelism, our spreading the gospel, I think that's gotten a little bit harder, which is good for us. How many of us rely, how many of us when we were, our evangelism was limited to, shaking hands at the front door when a visitor came in. And they came, we saw them twice a week, or even our fellowship with our fellow brothers and sisters. It was limited to that. Well, now we can't really do that as well anymore, can we? So what do? We have to call. We have to send a card. We might have to go actually visit someone. You know, it's a little more difficult to do that, but I think it's a little more powerful and works a little bit better than maybe our ways before. So it's good to think about those things. You know, always I'm a very positive person, so I like to look at the bright side of stuff like that. So that's kind of where my mind goes. I don't like to focus on the negatives. I'm looking for the positives. What can we do? What can we, you know? I think that's having a mind to work. That mindset. Do you still desire Egypt? I think that's a good question as well. All those things we've talked about, that those routines from before, a past life, a past activity, an addiction, any of those things are things we look back at longingly sometimes. But what has God said? You shall not return that way again. He's not just talking about the Israelites never physically going back to Egypt. He doesn't want their minds to go back to Egypt. He doesn't want their hearts to go back to Egypt. And of course, what is Egypt? It's not just slavery, but that is sin. And that's the idea that God wants for us. We have been called out of Egypt in a way. We have been called out of that slavery and sin. He does not want us to go back to that at all. Have you even left Egypt? Look at 1 Corinthians. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. This is Paul tying us in today's day, tying the Corinthians in that day back to the children of Israel. We were not physically there, but in a sense, we have that same journey. If we've been baptized, we've been baptized through water, just as the Israelites passed through the water to salvation. And, we drink spiritual food, or we eat spiritual food, and we drink spiritual drink, and that is the gospel. That is the living water that Jesus spoke about in John. So we have this. We have very similar paths. So our question is, are we going to continue to follow the path of Israel and constantly look back, or are we going to have a mind to work and look and march forward, press on toward the call of the upper of the... Okay, I can't even remember that verse. Hold on. Romans chapter 6. Therefore we are buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. That is our goal today, and that is our question. Have you left Egypt? Have you been baptized? Have you passed through the water to salvation in Christ? And if you have, that's amazing. But have you left Egypt? Do you still desire Egypt? Have you put away that Egypt, that life of slavery and sin? Have you put that away? And if not, are you ready to leave their former life and pass through the waters to newness of life and salvation? So I appreciate you listening to me today. Again, consider those things as we go throughout our day. And again, if you have not left Egypt, it is time to do that now. And the way to do that is through the water. And I'm sure the brethren here will be happy to baptize you and help you leave Egypt once and for all. So if you would like to, please do that now as we stand and sing.
I am resolved no longer to linger, charmed by the world's delight. Things that are